This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Speaking ill of the dead is something we tend to do very admirably in this country. And this series of lectures merely allows a public platform for the expression of antipathy, deserved or otherwise, towards prominent figures in Irish history. In programme 4 in our series of lectures recorded last March in the National Museum, we discover how it's possible to find fault with a Nobel Peace Prize winner. In this case, former Foreign Relations Minister Sean McBride. Professor David Norris, Joycean scholar and Trinity College senator, has little time for the Nobel and Lenin Peace Prize winner, his antipathy having much to do with his long friendship with Noel Brown, one time ally and then antagonist of McBride in the 1950s inter-party government over the controversial mother and child scheme.
There is something within me that naturally recoils from the notion of speaking ill of the dead. To be advocatus diaboli in this fashion seems so absolute, and our general title is, of course, a twist on the old Latin dictum, de mortuis nil nisi bonum, of the dead, nothing but the good, which is in itself a little unbalanced. I do not propose to demonise Sean McBride, rather to balance the hagiographers by illuminating what I see as some of the more questionable aspects of this complex character. At the time of his death in 1988, I caused something of a stink myself in Shannadarran when I attempted to distance myself from the pious platitudes of my colleagues who were intent on celebrating his demise with a fulsome Republican tribute. Virtually all of my contribution was rendered inaudible by what are euphemistically described by the official transcript as interruptions. I had indicated that while naturally one felt sympathy in a human sense towards those bereaved, there could be no concealing the fact that McBride was a colourful and highly controversial character. I went on to say, although this appears to have been drowned out by the clamour, that the one thing I imagined I shared in common with him was a distaste for the pieties, in some cases quite hypocritical, with which he was being showered. Let me acknowledge at the start that I do have a bias. I have never greatly warmed to gunmen. Indeed, when I look at the title I chose, The Assassin's Cloak, by which I meant not merely his early career and continued association with violent republicanism, but more particularly his mean-spirited attempts at character assassination of figures greatly, in my opinion, his morally superior, such as Noel Brown, I feel that perhaps an even more appropriate title would have been Sean McBride, The Shadow of a Gunman. For it was a shadow that, like the Provisional IRA, never quite went away. Nor do I imagine that he would have disliked this sobriquet, for in his posthumously published memoirs he has given us a number of examples of the pleasure he took in toying with guns from his early teens, and more curiously delivered himself of a number of compliments on his working attire. I was reasonably well known in the locality and dressed rather dapperly. I used to wear a yellow waistcoat, not that I especially liked fine clothes, but I was usually dapper on these occasions. These occasions were, in fact, ambushes, and he details them in a clinical manner that is remarkably free from any sense of compassion or identification with the victim. I don't remember the casualty figures. Not many in Mount Street, although we wounded quite a number and disabled some of their tenders. Our objective was to get hand grenades into lorries to disable the soldiers, kill them, and destroy the vehicle. McBride, apparently, was not just a natty dresser for occasions of ambush or assassination. He continued his taste for sartorial elegance, for which he again chooses the word dapper, when he was engaged in a gun-running operation in Germany in 1922. I was dressed rather dapperly, with my carnation and a pair of gloves, not at all in keeping with the surroundings. It made me conspicuous. However, he did subsequently discover a distaste for the death penalty, as a result of witnessing a series of miscarriages of justice committed both by British military courts and the IRA kangaroo courts. There are, of course, extenuating circumstances. Principal among these, one must include family background, which I think could be satisfactorily covered by Dr. Gareth Fitzgerald's elegant phrase about another Irish politician, a flawed pedigree. His mother, Maud Gonne, was something of a rackety gal. She was the daughter of a colonel in the British Army, and in fact had no Irish blood whatever. She came from a wealthy Anglican background in England and was well acquainted with the county set with whom she attended hunt balls and other festivities in both England and Ireland. Prior to meeting Sean McBride's father, she had had an extended liaison with the French adventurer Lucien Millevoye, by whom she had two children, a boy who died in infancy and Sean McBride's half-sister Isolde. However, she took a fancy to Ireland, which she had visited when her father was stationed at the Curragh military camp, converted to Catholicism, became a fiery, gun-toting Republican, and despite her lack of a single corpuscle of Irish blood, founded Inní na Héireann, the Daughters of Erin, and attended as an official Irish representative the Irish Race Convention in Paris in 1922. She also passed on to her son a disposition to take a provocatively anti-British line. Nor did she suffer from undue diffidence as an English woman in operating as a judge of the Sinn Féin courts. Indeed, Maud Gonne's expression of her newfound religion was at the more florid end of the scale, according to her biographer Anthony Jordan. Maud and her son were received in private audience in the Vatican by Pope Pius X. The following morning, Sean assisted at the Pope's Mass, and he and Maud received Holy Communion from the Holy Father. A few years later, on the 21st of June 1913, Sean was confirmed by Cardinal Amet, the Archbishop of Paris. This was no ordinary mother and child, indeed. His father, John MacBride, had earned the ire of the poet W.B. Yeats, who was his rival for the love of Maud Gonne, on account of what Yeats considered as his drunken boorishness, combined with repeated, though unconfirmed, suggestions that he had sexually molested his stepdaughter. Nevertheless, from Yeats's point of view, these flaws were glorified out of MacBride's character by the terrible beauty that was 1916. Whatever about prurient speculation, there is no doubt that Maud Gonne vigorously expelled John MacBride from the family home and circle within a few months of the birth of his son, and that Sean MacBride had virtually no contact with him until, while still a schoolboy, he had to confront the harrowing circumstances of his father's death. Mercifully, the French order, whose school he was attending at that time, delivered this blow in as gentle a manner as possible. Although W.B. Yeats developed surprisingly paternal feelings for the young Sean MacBride, I have to conclude that the absence of a real father figure and the fact that his mother dragged him around Europe and the British Isles in a series of St. Trinian-style Republican escapades could not but have had an unsettling effect on the formation of his personality. His early education in France left him with a pronounced French accent, which he cultivated to the end of his long life and which caused some derision among his opponents, who suspected that a less vain man might have acquired an accent more in keeping with his passionate identification with Mother Ireland. Even late in life, some of his legal colleagues delighted in stories about his accent. One in particular concerned an outbreak of Tong warfare among the Chinese restaurants of central Dublin. MacBride was appointed counsel in one of these cases, and during cross-examination addressed a witness saying, "Mr. Wong, is it true that you run a restaurant in Ranelagh?" Mr. Wong very naturally replied, "What?" And the judge then instructed MacBride to repeat the question, which he did. "Mr. Wong, is it true that you run a restaurant in Ranelagh?" To which Mr. Wong again replied, "What?" At which point the judge intervened to say wearily, "He's asking, do you run a chipper in Rathmines?" This is a light-hearted story, but it may also illustrate something about MacBride. I heard a parallel story from an acquaintance who happened to know Henry Kissinger's brother and asked him why he, the brother, had no trace of a German accent, whereas Henry sounded as if he'd just bounced in from Munich. The brother replied that, "Unlike Henry, I listen to other people." MacBride's hearing could also be selective. Both mother and son involved themselves in the 1916 rebellion, which was almost universally unpopular in the beginning and only received support due to the callous stupidity of the British in organising a long drawn out series of brutal executions. This led to the Sinn Féin victory in the election of 1918. The Dáil then convened and by democratic majority voted to accept the treaty. Sean MacBride was among those who refused to accept the wish of the Irish people and became involved in the occupation of the Four Courts. During the early part of this occupation, his antics were not confined to the Four Courts area, and both he himself and the late Dr. C.S. Andrews have left descriptions of his escapades at this period. These included commandeering civilian cars at gunpoint for joyriding expeditions into the countryside, during one of which he crashed into an army lorry in Nassau Street in a stolen car, but managed to abandon the vehicle, hopping out and waving his pistol about his head. Indeed, his reputation as a gunman flourished to such an extent that following the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins, he was arrested for the murder, a crime which he could not have committed. He might, in fact, have suffered the ultimate penalty were it not for the integrity of a Unionist member of Shanadaran, Major Brian Cooper, who gave evidence that at the time of the assassination, he had actually been engaged in conversation with Sean MacBride on the mailboat in the middle of the Irish Sea. By 1931, MacBride and Padder O'Donnell combined to form a new Republican organization, political in constitution, but with a heavy penetration of IRA personnel, Sayre era. Characteristically, in his memoir, Sean MacBride suggests that his own involvement in this movement provoked the jealousy of Padder O'Donnell, who wanted to have the stage all to himself, and subsequently left MacBride to do all the hard work and eventually be carted off once more to jail. In his speech at the founding of Sayre era in the Iona Hall in Northgate, Georgia Street, MacBride railed against the British and the privileged classes. He called for the dispossession of the aliens from their privileged position in Irish society, apparently quite untroubled by the fact that it would not be unjust to suggest there was a certain whiff of alien privilege about his own background. This can be illustrated by the fact that even during the Second World War, the MacBride menage at Roebuck House included a chauffeur, cook, parlourmaid, kitchenmaid, sewingmaid, and two gardeners, and even MacBride's unpaid resident amanuensis, Louis O'Brien, also herself employed a maid. Perhaps it was this background of which Frank Aiken was thinking when on the 7th of November 1947 he referred to MacBride ironically as the Kingstown Republican. In 1934, a group of Protestant workers from the Shankill Road decided to dip a toe into the Republican puddle. A lorry load of them travelled down to take part in the Republican rally at Bowdenstown in memory of Wolfe Tone, whose ideal it was to reconcile Protestant, Catholic and dissenter. At this stage, there were two distinct elements within the Republican movement. One had a rather confessional Catholic tinge, while the other veered towards progressive socialist ideas. MacBride belonged to the Catholic wing and was in effect one of its principal leaders. When the Protestant workers arrived at Bowdenstown, they were ambushed by the Southern Republicans, beaten up and expelled from the graveyard. While I have discovered no written authorization from MacBride for this, there is little doubt that it could not have happened without his consent. In 1936, Sean MacBride became chief of staff of the IRA following the arrest of Moss Toomey. However, the following year he was got rid of, and someone regarded as more representative of the Irish people, Sean Russell, later to become an active collaborator with the Nazis, was installed. At this point, MacBride claimed to have accepted the 1937 Constitution and severed his official connection with the IRA. In 1946, Sean MacBride once more spearheaded a movement to set up a new party, this time to be called Clun na Poblachta. The party's programme included the reunification of Ireland and a vigorous economic and social agenda. In the 1947 general election, Clun na Poblachta won 10 seats and joined a coalition government with Fine Gael, Labour and Clann na Talún. MacBride's republicanism did not fade with his inclusion in the cabinet. After he got himself made Minister for External Affairs, one of his main objectives was to sever the link with his mother's native country, England. MacBride was in fact prepared to remain within the Commonwealth and indeed to join NATO, but the price of this was the reunification of the country. Interestingly, Mr. De Valera, a wily politician and strategist, was forced into a corner by MacBride's manoeuvring and was unable to come out with his real position, which was that remaining as an independent republic within the Commonwealth might constitute a bridge with the Northern Unionists. The views of Gareth Fitzgerald on this matter are also of interest. I had been brought up to regard MacBride with deep hostility. A member of the IRA from the Civil War onwards, he had been its chief of staff in the mid-30s, just after some particularly shocking murders had made a profound impression on me, including one near Ring College when I was in school there. His later conversion to constitutionalism had seemed to me ambivalent. My unhappiness was intensified when the Taoiseach announced the government's intention to declare a republic. At that time, this clearly meant leaving the Commonwealth, for the evolution of which into a body of sovereign independent states, John Costello as Attorney General, with people like my father, Paddy McGilligan and Kevin O'Higgins, had worked so successfully in the years before 1932. The leader of the British Liberal Party declared that while it would seem that the purpose of ERA in deciding to become an independent republic was to secure the reunion of Ireland, they had now taken the one step most calculated to defeat that purpose. Moreover, 2 days after the declaration of the Irish Republic and the repeal of the External Relations Act, India secured the status of a republic, but has remained to this day within the Commonwealth. However, despite whatever doubts one may have about the wisdom of this action, there can be no doubting MacBride's intellectual brilliance in the debate between himself and Mr. De Valera, in which he forensically dissected De Valera's ambivalence. The most imaginative feature of this administration was the appointment of a young, intensely motivated doctor, Noel Brown, to the Department of Health. Noel Brown's family had been devastated by tuberculosis, and he made it his principal aim to eradicate this scourge from Irish life. Dealing with the appointment of Brown, MacBride employs a classic smear tactic, writing that Brown was a young man who was or had come from Trinity College and that kind of conservative unionist background. I don't think that at that time I knew he was the son of an RIC man. This is classic MacBride, caricaturing Noel Brown, a man from an impoverished, TB-ridden peasant family in the west of Ireland, as a member of the Trinity establishment with a conservative unionist background. Moreover, far from being an RIC man, Brown's father was, in fact, an RSPCA inspector who lost his job when he contracted TB. In his posthumous memoir, Sean MacBride does everything to claim credit for this scheme while simultaneously dissociating himself from responsibility for the mother and child debacle which was to follow. May I say, from a 20 years practical knowledge of politics in this country, every department in the state is stuffed with good ideas, plans, programs, and proposed legislation which never come to fruition. Whatever else can be said, it is incontrovertibly true that Noel Brown acted upon these proposals and by his individual energy secured their implementation. Brown then moved on to the provision of maternal services by the state in the notorious mother and child scheme. Once again in his memoirs, MacBride seeks to undermine Noel Brown's responsibility for this on the grounds that a tentative proposal of this nature already existed in the department. Indeed, it did. A watered-down version of such a scheme had been timidly mooted by Mr. De Valera, but he immediately beat a strategic retreat at the mere suggestion of a belt from an ecclesiastical crozier. Noel Brown rapidly reinstated a fuller version of this with provision for free health care for mothers and their children up to the age of 16. This caused some disquiet among the fat cats of the medical profession, but most particularly evoked a negative response from within the Roman Catholic hierarchy, who saw here a symptom of creeping communism. They stated that the right to provide for the health of children belongs to parents and not to the state. This theoretical position completely ignored the parlous state of many families in the Ireland of the 1940s. However, the opposition of the church was enough to provoke a major crisis. The Taoiseach John A. Costello said, "I am an Irishman second, I am a Catholic first, and I accept without qualification in all respects the teaching of the hierarchy and the church to which I belong." During the actual Dáil debate, he said, "I, as a Catholic, obey my church authorities and will continue to do so." In the middle of this crisis, MacBride and Brown met for dinner in the Russell Hotel in November 1950 at MacBride's suggestion. MacBride has left an account of this in which he claims that Noel Brown declared his intention of destroying Clonmacnoise, bringing down the government, humiliating MacBride, and if possible replacing him as leader. There were no witnesses to this exchange, although MacBride did make a contemporaneous note. I have read this note. I knew both Sean MacBride and Noel Brown. I am proud to have been able to call Noel Brown a friend of mine for nearly 30 years. He was a man of honour, integrity and compassion. I also knew Sean MacBride, although not terribly well. In my dealings with him, I found him narrow, Machiavellian, cunning and evasive. I do not accept MacBride's version of events as in any sense likely to reflect the truth. At the reconvened cabinet meeting, Noel Brown asked each member in turn for support. Not one person was prepared to challenge the right of the Roman Catholic hierarchy to dictate policy to the government of Ireland. A day or two later, Sean MacBride dismissed Noel Brown from his government. In his memoirs, MacBride claims that Noel Brown had said to him on a number of occasions prior to this, "If I can really pick a row with the Irish hierarchy, I will be made." I give this no credence whatever. It is difficult to comprehend how MacBride imagined his ecclesiastical kowtowing would assist in his programme for incorporating a million or so uncooperative Protestants into his workers' republic. The net result was the collapse of the coalition. By 1957, MacBride, unlike Noel Brown, had become unelectable and withdrew from parliamentary politics while continuing a career at national and international level as a lawyer. He had already been partly responsible for the European Convention of Human Rights and the establishment of the European Court of Human Rights under the Council of Europe, and this is greatly to his credit. It is, however, highly unlikely that MacBride would have welcomed many of the decisions which subsequently emerged from that court, including my own victory on the question of the decriminalisation of homosexual behaviour. I only knew MacBride in the last 10 years of his life. I had been prominent in the struggle for gay liberation since the early 1970s, and was one of those responsible for the creation of the International Gay Association. As a result, I was contacted by a Finnish gay group who were under very considerable surveillance pressure and the threat of physical brutality from the Russian police. They sent to me an appeal that this matter should be brought up at a meeting of international jurists in Geneva, where Ireland was to be represented by Sean MacBride. I wrote him a detailed explanatory note and enclosed documentation from the Finnish group, requesting that he take an interest in this matter. To my astonishment, the entire parcel was opened, my letter was opened and read, and then my letter reinserted in its envelope, the whole thing parceled up and posted back to me without as much as a single word of acknowledgement. I had not expected such brutal ignorance from a man such as MacBride, but I would have done so had I known of his views on homosexual behaviour, which he subsequently expressed in an interview at the Crane Bag with Paddock Kirby. When Kirby raised the question of discrimination against gay people, MacBride blithely dismissed it, bracketing homosexuals with heroin addicts and not entirely flattering companionship. But there was even worse. I had become passionately concerned at the fate of the great humanitarian and Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg. He had saved a large number of Hungarian Jews by going in unarmed onto the cattle trains taking them to Auschwitz, braving the armed might of the Gestapo and issuing them with Swedish passports. He was subsequently captured by the Russians and disappeared into the Soviet gulag. I raised his fate by formal motion at the 1983 General Meeting of Amnesty. MacBride made every effort to quench my initiative. And to my horror, at the 1984 AGM in Hatch Street, I discovered that he had actually succeeded in deleting every reference to Wallenberg from the record. I subsequently insisted upon an amendment to the minutes to include a reference to this situation. Raoul Wallenberg was one of the greatest heroes of the 20th century, but tragically was never adopted by Amnesty as a prisoner of conscience. Why should MacBride take this attitude? Was it to ingratiate himself with his Soviet friends who had conferred upon him the Lenin Prize for Peace? Or was it that he knew, as I was to discover only later, that Raoul Wallenberg was himself homosexual? Whatever the reason, there was, in my opinion, no excuse. MacBride's homophobia also led him to complete blindness about the situation in Ireland. He told his Crane Bag interviewer that although the Irish were naturally intolerant people, which I question, there was no legal discrimination whatever in the Republic. Presumably, he thought gay people didn't exist at all, even though I had attempted on numerous occasions to draw his attention to the state of affairs here regarding this oppression. In conclusion, I have a somewhat quirky grudge against Sean MacBride from the field of Joycean studies. I was friendly with the late Maria Jolas, who published Finnegan's Wake in episodic form in Paris in the 1930s. She told me that in the aftermath of the Irish state bringing the body of the poet W.B. Yeats back to Ireland by gunboat after the war, Nora Joyce approached the Irish government to see if they would do something similar for her late husband. The matter went to government. And Mariah told me that for some reason, Sean MacBride refused to support it, and the matter was spiked. Harriet Weaver, a year or two later, wished to find an appropriate resting place for the manuscript of Finnegan's Wake. She wanted to donate it to the National Library in Dublin. However, according to Maria Jolas, when this was broached with Nora Joyce, she absolutely refused to countenance such a plan in the light of MacBride's refusal. One of the most significant manuscripts of the 20th century was lost forever to Ireland. The outline of this regrettable situation is referred to in Brenda Maddox's biography of Nora Joyce, but without specific reference to MacBride's role. Towards the end of his life, MacBride was given significant honours internationally. He received the Congressional Medal of Honour from America, the Lenin Prize, and the Nobel Peace Prize. However, it might be noted that among other recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize around that time were those well-known men of peace, Menachem Begin and Henry Kissinger. Sean MacBride died in January 1988. He was a complex, talented, and somewhat sinister personality. He helped to create the machinery for human rights legislation in Europe, opposed nuclear armaments, and served the United Nations well in Namibia. He deserves our gratitude for helping to establish Amnesty International, but he remains narrow, sectarian, and too close for comfort to the armed Republican movement. He was a man without self-awareness or a sense of irony. Richard Mulcahy summed him up well, in my opinion, in a review of his posthumous memoir, saying, "MacBride emerges as a man of energy, with a wide interest in social, economic, and political affairs. However, he also emerges from his own writings as a man of unusual vanity, less than charitable to his opponents, happy in the company of world figures, consistent in seeing himself in a favorable light, and without providing the necessary evidence to allow historians to take an impartial view of his contributions to recent Irish history."
Senator David Norris speaking ill of Sean MacBride. Professor Norris referred in his talk to MacBride's biographer, Anthony Jordan. As it happens, Anthony Jordan was in the audience and in a contribution from the floor offered considerable support to the senator's thesis.
I think David Norris has given a fine paper and has captured the essence of Sean MacBride. When the reviews came out of my own book, I was horrified to find that most of the reviews had zoned in on the negative aspects of his character, of which, unfortunately, there were many. And I just make a couple of points about what David said. One of the things on Noel Brown, unfortunately for Sean MacBride, Noel Brown has won the publicity battle. And my own view is that I believe Sean MacBride acted as he had to act in that particular thing. And I would hold Noel Brown responsible for the debacle of an excellent particular scheme. He was not a practical politician, and unfortunately in those days the church did have considerable power. The only other point I'd like to make is that in the Declaration of the Republic and the Mother and Child Scheme, it's very often forgotten that John A. Costello was the Taoiseach at the time. It was a Fine Gael majority government, and they were the ones calling the shots, and particularly the Declaration of the Republic was Costello's doing. Okay, MacBride would have wanted it and supported it, but Costello went ahead, as he said, more or less, to take the clothes out of Clonapublica, to undo the power they had by doing what they wanted, to get in first, in fact. But I'd like to congratulate you on a terrific talk.
Sean MacBride's biographer, Anthony Jordan, offering some support to Senator David Norris's attempted demolition of the Nobel Peace Prize winner's political reputation. Next week, Professor Tom Bartlett of UCD on that great bête noir of Irish history, The Informer.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.